This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 128. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
And you can call us on
0208 816 7691 and international numbers on the website.
I'm David Hinchliffe.
I'm the boss.
Well, welcome back to the show, boss. Berners is indisposed again. We've lost track of him again, but you've stepped into the breach.
Yes, last we heard he was sunning himself down in Cape Town with the Cobras down there, having a lovely time, and pleasure to be back.
Well, yes, yeah, so I can highly approve of Cape Town as a place to be, even in this early part of their summer, which is still about 10 times better than the weather we're having here in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, to all our South African listeners, you don't know how lucky you are.
I don't know if I said this on the show, but when we were doing our filming for JP Duminy's online coaching course, some of the Western Province squad members were taken outside by the strength coach, and they were doing their speed drills and agility drills outside in the 25 degree, not a cloud in the sky heat. And this is supposed to be their winter. And I said, "How about this weather?" to one of them, and he said, "Yeah, it's been a terrible winter."
Well, that's what I was about to say, David. 25 degrees is not hot.
Well, yeah, not for South Africa. No, definitely not.
Yeah,
it's been a terrible winter.
Actually, in the JP Duminy clip, you can see them in the background of a bit of it, can't you? Them doing those sprints.
Yeah, you can see a little bit of it. Yeah, we don't focus on it, but yeah, they're there in the background. So it's definitely a working place even in the depths of winter. You can't really do that if you're in Chelmsford or Durham. It's just
no.
You'd be bogged down by the snow, even in April.
Even in August, some years.
Yeah. But speaking of county championships, it's quite interesting this week that they're doing some trials with floodlit cricket and pink balls in the county championship.
It's
a dead match that they're playing with. But that's an interesting development. What do you think about that first-class cricket played under lights?
I think it's very, very interesting how this is going to pan out. And you know, if I dare offer an opinion on this, the thing, there are a lot of people who are, and senior administrators that I've spoken to, who are, you know, very enthusiastic about night test matches and night one first class matches. And, you know, I defer to their experience in some respects. But personally, you see, if I go to a first class match, if I go to a match that is not a one day or a 2020, it's more a languid experience. It's more about sitting in the stands, enjoying the sun over a lazy afternoon to watch a test match. It's not something I would perhaps do in an evening for 4 or 5 hours after work. Mm. And I say that as a huge fan of test cricket too, because I believe test cricket's incredibly entertaining. But it's a slower experience. And I don't know if, you know, as the temperature comes down to 15 or 14 degrees in the evening and I'm sitting in the stands of a test match or a first-class match, I'm not sure if I would feel as comfortable as I would at home. You know, maybe at the end of the day it's about TV money rather than the people attending the ground. It's about pushing the game into prime time as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's probably going to help with television attendances, isn't it? Where you're comfortable in your own armchair, it's not so much of a problem what's going on.
Yes, but you see, then you've got to again think about it as an entertainment package. So, 2020 is the best example, is a game explicitly packaged for prime time TV.
Yeah,
and it's competing with the likes of the X Factor and MasterChef and things like that.
Yeah.
Test cricket isn't packaged in that way. Now, if you're sitting in the sofa at 7:30 at night, or you know, after dinner, after work, are you going to sit and watch a slow game, or are you going to chip over to the X Factor or to Lithuania's Got Talent or something like that instead, because it's packaged, it's more explicitly packaged that way. I don't know, interesting times.
What about you, Boss? Would you want to play that type of cricket, or are you more of a Sunday afternoon, enjoy the sunshine and...
Well, no, actually, as a person who's got work and family commitments, I'd be far more likely to play if I could play in a weekday evening, for sure.
And talking about the club game, I also noticed that Australia and Sri Lanka have been, and the match referees have been kicking up a bit of a fuss about the quality of the pitch in the first test at Gore when a lot of wickets fell.
Shock, horror, wickets fell.
But us club players are pretty used to those kind of pitches. I don't know if the batsmen are getting a bit carried away with themselves.
Yeah, it's actually another interesting question as to whether at the professional level the batsmen are entitled to a certain level of playability in a wicket, or whether it's simply a wicket where the batsmen need to apply themselves more and they failed to do so. It sounds, arguably you could say that the cricketers are being a little bit precious because if 9 times out of 10 the wickets generally favour the batsman and 1 time out of 10 it's a tough wicket, so what? As long as both teams are playing under the same conditions, I fail to see that what's the worst that happens is it's providing a bit of variety. Fine. Maybe if you're a professional you'd feel differently, because obviously your career and your percentages and your sponsorships all depend on your performances, and if you're feeling you're batting on a pitch that's going to undermine your ability to perform, that perhaps carries a certain amount of significance.
But it shows how much it's a batsman's game, in the fact that when you have a test match where 600 play 700, everybody says it's a really good pitch, even though it ends in a draw.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas if someone's bowled out for 150 and then the other side are bowled out for 212, then everybody says it's a terrible pitch and it's costing people their careers.
Yeah.
So you have to bemoan the lot of the bowler. I'm quite glad I'm not a bowler. It's not a happy existence sometimes, I think.
No, especially not these days.
So, yeah, I'm all for the occasional quote-unquote bad pitch. I think, it's a challenge to the batsman, isn't it? See, how good really is your technique?
As long as it's not physically dangerous, as long as the ball's not rearing at your chin off a good length, then, it's a challenge of your ability and your technique, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And this one was turning square and, it wasn't easy to play, but, it wasn't dangerous, so... we've all played on pretty horrible pitches, and you've got to see it as a challenge rather than. I mean, to be fair, I don't think the Australian batsmen have complained too much, so that's good to see. But then again, they did win the match, so
yes.
maybe it's easy not to complain when you walk away as a winner.
Yeah, and it's not just the pitches, of course; it's the outfield as well. I often think you often hear about people lauding the professional cricketers' fielding abilities, which are, they are extraordinary, but they do have the inherent advantage of playing on outfields that are very, very well prepared and very, very predictable bounces and things. So they do have the opportunity to attack the ball. So club level players, we don't have that privilege most games, especially at lower grades. Mm. It's usually a football field in the winter. So it's harder to attack the ball and harder to refine your fielding skills on an uneven outfield. Probably if you put club cricketers on a level playing field with nice outfields, I think the gap between the average professional fielder and a good club fielder is probably not that great.
Oh, certainly not. I think really the key message is that... you should work even harder. If you're playing club cricket, you should work even harder on your fielding than you do on anything else, because it is more difficult when you're playing on difficult outfields.
Yeah.
So, yeah, put in the work. Don't leave it to the end. Like often I've seen in club training sessions, well, we'll do some fielding at the end, and then when it gets to the end, everybody suddenly is very busy and has to go and get their dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the eternal... the eternal issue at club level, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fielding practice.
Yeah. So do it first. That's my, you know, that's that, such a simple thing. Do your fielding before anyone puts their pads on.
Well, I have one incentive for doing fielding practice is I would rather do fielding practice and feel slightly bored than drop a catch in the match and feel that reddening, horrible moment of shame for having for me, the payoff is there. Take the catch or stop the ball or whatever. It's I'd much prefer to do fielding practice than to feel that shame.
It's time now for our weekly interview, and this week we're taking a little bit of a step back, or a slight step back from cricket, and we're going to look at coaching in a little bit more general terms. And joining me on the line now is Joe Shilliker of SM1 Coaching. Joe, you have a degree in sports coaching. You've set up a coaching company. So where do you see the role of sport in schools and the development of children?
Well, it's changed a lot recently with all the depressing stories of school sports funding being cut with the new government in. And I think that now is a really important time to really focus on the importance of sport in schools and how it not only develops children's sporting abilities, but also how sport as a whole can affect other educational developments for children as well, in more stronger curriculum subjects.
So that's interesting. Playing a sport like cricket improves your grades, your academic grades, and your personal and social development. How does that work? What's the cause behind that, do you think?
Well, interesting you say that. I actually spent a lot of time during my university degree researching that kind of exact subject of whether sport does affect children's grades and behaviour. And I spent some time in a local primary school doing exactly that. I did daily physical activity every day with a group of kids. And I noticed over the course of a month the changes in behaviour with a group of children. After doing PE in the day, their behaviour was dramatically improved because they were able to kind of like release that energy that they wouldn't have been able to being sat in a classroom. So they had more time to focus on their academic studies, and also it kind of refreshed their memories. And there's a big push on exercising children's minds with exercise, and I think it's something that schools really undervalue at the moment in helping their educational abilities through sport.
A lot of children are not that into their sport. I mean, there are a lot of children who, you know, love playing football and cricket and rugby and all sports like that. But there's a lot of children who are not so much into that, you know, the less active children. Does it have a similar effect on those children, or does the negative experience balance it out?
I think that part comes down to what kind of coach you are as well. Some coaches are very good at introducing a sport for all kind of ethos and encouraging some of the kids who aren't necessarily as strong in sport to really partake in sporting activities, to do that kind of thing. But you get some kids who respond better to different sort of subjects, such as art or music, where you can really focus a child's energies into that, which can then rub off in the same way that we think sport can. But if you make sure that your coaching and what you're teaching is appropriate to the child's abilities and ages and backgrounds, then I think if you structure it appropriately, then you have every chance of making sure that the child can develop through sport, I think.
So I'm thinking of maybe a club cricket coach or somebody like that. Perhaps they don't think about the wider implications of what influence sport is having on the children that they're coaching. What practical things can they do to make sure that everybody is enjoying the sport as much as possible, and not just the kids who are sporty?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to make it fun and make it interesting for the kids. I always say that no matter what situation you're in, you're more likely to learn something or improve something if you're enjoying it. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of coaches overlook, is that enjoyment factor. You can do drills and skills and things with some kids and some adults as well that are happy to just kind of tick along with more technical based coaching. But if you branch it out and make it interesting, play games and offer incentives for kids, then I think that goes a long way to really engaging with the child and making them think about what they're doing in a sporting sense as well.
So give me an example of a typical session that you would do with, I don't know, let's talk about 10-year-olds, just to pick a random age. How would you structure a session like that to make it fun and interesting and a different, say, from just going in the nets and someone having a bat and everybody queuing up to bowl?
Yeah, I think nets are great for when you want to do some sort of technical coaching or just get them to sort of have a bat and have a bowl. But for me, I'd start off with a warm-up and I'd make sure that the warm-up was related to what I was going to do in the main session. Because obviously if you're going to do a batting drill, then you don't want to be throwing a ball around all the time. You'd want to get the bats involved with the warm-up maybe, and vice versa with bowling or fielding. And I'd try and do, maybe if I was playing the straight drive, I'd start off by talking about the basic technical aspects of it, but keep it simple and get them into a game. Give them some targets to hit at and give them points for hitting the targets, and that they don't feel like they're doing some boring, tedious drills, that it's fun, it's engaging, it's progressive as well, so that they can then move on to do something a bit more advanced later on the session, thinking of the skills that they've already done in the previous warm-up and the first kind of drills. I think it's very important to make sure that the kids are progressive in that, in their work, and also that they can play games, because I think that it sounds kind of simple and easy, but it's something very important to keep kids infused and interested.
Well, it's an interesting area and obviously one that you care passionately about. So what kind of services do you offer in your coaching company?
Well, we look to work mostly in schools. We're based in the Oxfordshire area, and trying to just make school PE and school lessons and just anything to do with children fun and relevant, and working in schools, making sure that we have healthy, encouraged active lifestyles and social, personal, physical development through sport. And also, if you look at the state of school sports, I know when I was back in school, it was very poorly run. Maybe that was just my school. But you look at the cuts for the school funding. They've axed £164 million, I think it is, for school sports partnerships, which are fantastic for promoting sport in schools. And to have funding like that that's gone, I think there's a real kind of like downbeat vibe in school sports. And I think it's very important to provide the best possible sports for schools. And that's where we kind of want to step in and really make sure that schools realise how important sport is for the development of their children, and organising, sort of developing sports and celebrating achievement as well. So it's not all just about top personal scores and being the best. It's about developing the person as a whole and making sure that each child develops in the same with any subject. For example, if you take a literacy lesson, you don't want every child to get to the top. Obviously it's nice, but some children have to progress at their own pace, and that's the same thing that you want to introduce in sport, is that not every child's going to play international cricket, for example, but you want them to be the best that they can be and provide the best environment for that child to develop to the top of their game.
And if people want to find out more about what you do, you have a website?
Yeah, we do. We have a website that's sm1coaching.co.uk, and we have lots of interesting aspects to our services, what we do, also links to our research, where there's three of us who work together, and we're all university graduates from sport and coaching. So we've done lots of research with some of the things I've just spoke about, with child development and what it is to sort of infuse children in sport, why children drop out of sport, and grassroots coaching. So we really look to implement some of the work we've done through university into our coaching.
Joe Schilliger of SM1 Coaching, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Time now on the show for the questions section. And as you know, the best question of the week wins a prize, which is a coaching course, an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Boss, you've got a couple of questions this week for us to examine. What do you think is the best question to go first?
The question is from Steve. Why are Indian players so fat and unfit? I'm not sure that they are. I think some of their players in the test series have been, and therefore a bit, you know, it was notable that their performance in the field was down. But I think that's just a product of they've got a relatively old squad. I don't think they were, inherently unfit or fat. I don't think they were fat. Maybe Shaywe was a bit fat. I don't know.
Yeah, he had been injured though. Yeah, well, it is an interesting question because you can definitely see a difference between certainly a number of Indian players and the general standards that you see in other countries, particularly England, Australia, and South Africa, where and to a lesser extent the West Indies, where fitness levels are noticeably higher as a general rule. So it's a bit of an emotively wordy question, saying why are Indian players fat and unfit. I think that's an unfair question. I don't think you can say that as a broad brushstroke.
They just won the World Cup. You don't win the World Cup with fat and unfit players.
Precisely.
You know, one bad test series. You can't draw a judgment. It's certainly true. I think it does go in cycles a little bit, and it does. There is such a thing as an internal team culture that develops around setting standards in the field.
Definitely.
That rubs off on everywhere, and I think at different periods in the last decade, Australia certainly had that. England certainly has it now, and perhaps India doesn't quite have it now. But you can fall back in some of the best cricketers in the world have been fat and unfit, actually. So, I.T. Botham, S.K. Warne, Booney. It's not necessarily the be-all and end-all of a cricketer.
No, I think the thing with fitness in general is, well, there's two things, really. One is how do you define what is fitness? You know, because if someone is fat but can... let's say if someone is looks overweight, appears to be overweight, but can do all the standard fitness tests that are required, and also can go and score 200 runs and bowl you 25 overs in a day, then what difference does it make whether he looks a bit podgy or not? Nothing really. And the other thing is that fitness is. It is an important measure, but it isn't the be-all and end-all. Skill is the most important thing. It's how much fitness adds to your skill is the real question, and how much you can transfer fitness over to performing your skills in a better way, whether that means performing the skills for a longer period or being more powerful or being more resistant to injury.
Yes.
So, if you look at an Indian player who's not particularly mobile in the field and maybe he's a bit overweight, or any player, not just an Indian player, any player from anywhere in the world, and you think to yourself, he's unfit, then you're not really making a fair measure of that particular player because you don't know how resistant he is to injury. You don't know how strong he is. You don't know how much stamina he's got, to do the job that's required. And you certainly don't know how skillful he is just by looking at him and going, well, he's a bit overweight, therefore, you know, he can't be a good player.
I guess if we read between the lines of Steve's question, there is a perception, whether true or false, that Indian professional players are a little bit reluctant to train or hit the gym. And that, you know, that's been mentioned by a few coaches here and there. And I guess it'd be interesting to hear from some of our Indian listeners actually about what the domestic view of that is, and whether that influences their own approach to cricket. Because funny thing is, we get tons and tons of emails from cricketers from India.
Yeah,
and I think without exception, they're always all expressing their desire to work hard. So definitely. So it doesn't seem to me that it would be it's in generic to a particular nation. I think, you know, maybe the professional class. I don't know. Well, Steve, I think Steve's just stirring the pot, frankly. Steve, stop stirring the pot.
Yeah, exactly. And having played club cricket in England for over 20 years, I can assure you that there's plenty of fat and unfit cricketers in the UK.
Yes.
So yes. Yeah, don't worry about that. And even at professional level, you know, if you look at Samit Patel, who had all those problems getting to the standards that required by England, you know, it's not to do with Indian players. it's a perennial problem. Fitness versus skill. It's a perennial problem, isn't it? What is the next question, boss?
It's from Glee. And okay, we're on a theme here. Do you know what exercises the England team do within the gym?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's coming from the other angle, isn't it? Who are certainly perceived as the fittest, most agile, you know, strongest, best performing team in the world? And certainly the perception at the moment is that it's England.
Yes.
That's what a lot of people have been writing anyway. So, yeah, that's interesting to know what they do in the gym. And although I've never spoken to Hugh Bevan, I think his name is, who's the main strength and conditioning guy there at Team England, I do have some experience of working with some first-class strength and conditioning coaches. So I know the kind of thing that they do. And it's interesting, the kinds of thing that they do are very, very far departed from what you would imagine that they might do. You know, you might think, well, you know, they're in the gym doing their bench presses, their press-ups and their squats and deadlifts and all that kind of thing. But a lot of the time, because they're playing pretty much 12 months of the year, they don't have an off-season. So they don't have any time, really, to work on the things that you would imagine that somebody would work on, you know, big lifts of heavy weights. They tend to focus a lot more on preventing injury. So it's not so much about improving performance, although there are elements of that, but it's more about how can I keep this guy on the puck?
Yes.
While he's playing for 12 months of the year.
So what could a club player then learn from what they do? Is there any relevance, or is it really a very different kettle of fish for them?
Because of that 12 months of the year thing, you can't. It's almost like it's a different game, you know. Because you're saying our number one focus by far is preventing injury and keeping that guy being able to play. Let's say 11 months of the year, because he gets rested nowadays. He gets a month's rest nowadays, and then in that 1 month that he's off, maybe he'll do some more focused stuff on improving performance, or 6 weeks that he's off, or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's almost the exact opposite to football, isn't it? I mean, football, you do a pre-season, you work up to a peak and do a taper just before the season starts, and then you maintain yourself through the season. Here, it's a maintaining at a certain level and just doing the odd taper before a tournament or something like that.
Yeah, they just get in what they can, basically. Yeah, they just do what they can. You know, if they have a... you know, if they have a week where they're not playing as much, then maybe they try and sneak in some extra performance-enhancing type stuff, you know, lifting weights type stuff. But generally, there's a lot of injury prevention type stuff, core training, and things that really, it's really very, very much more difficult to generalise about. That's why they all get personalised training programmes.
But is that then what club cricketers should be doing during the season then, themselves, or should club cricketers be doing something different? Club cricketers may have a different fitness base to begin with. So yeah. Should they do the same sort of maintenance things during the season, or should they be doing something different?
That's an interesting area, actually. But the traditional view would be, yes, you do something similar to what the professionals do year-round, which is maintain the fitness levels that you already have in a variety of markers. So, you know, you're not just talking about how many press-ups you can do. You're also talking about, you know, your endurance and your flexibility and your mobility and a wide range of things. Be able to maintain all of those and work on making sure that, you know, you don't get a hamstring pull or something like that, you know, because you're imbalanced somehow in your training program. So traditionally, yes, the answer would be, yeah, you follow a similar kind of program. But because the England team and all professional cricket, certainly in the UK, have such a personalised approach and such a customised approach, you know, they because things change because of weather and tours and things like that, it's very hard to set down a plan. They kind of do things on the fly. And I would say with a club cricketer, because you're a bit more set in what you do, you know, maybe you're playing on a Saturday and a Sunday and you know you're not going to be playing in the week, or maybe you play on the Saturday and you play on a Wednesday, something like that, and you know the days that you're going to be playing, apart from weather intervening, you could be fairly fixed in your plan throughout the course of the summer.
Yeah.
So it makes it easier in some ways. But yeah, the main lesson to take, I would say, is that you shouldn't really follow what England do, because it's so specialised for the type of cricket that they play. And in fact, as a club cricket, you've got an advantage. You can make improvements. You can make performance improvements because you're not playing as often and because you have that off-season to have a break and to work on performance.
Good. Like it.
Okay, it's time to wrap up the show. Time's winged chariot draws ever near, as they say. So before we go, we've just got time to find out who's going to win the prize, the Pitch Vision Academy online coaching course. Who had the best question this week, boss?
I'm not going to give it to Steve. Steve, you're clearly a troublemaker. So it's Glee. Regarding the exercises the England team do in the gym. Congratulations, Glee.
Congratulations, Glee. I recommend the fitness course from the Glamorgan Strength and Conditioning coach, Rob Armand. That's a good one to have if you want to know what type of exercises to do as a club cricketer. Now, to win that prize, you have to send in a question. And to send in a question, there's a variety of ways you can do so to get it read out on the show. Boss, you've got the phone number there and the email address for people to get in touch?
Yes, call in on 0208 816 7691. There's an answering machine there, which is available 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Or email through on coach@pitchvision.com.
You can also get us on Twitter. We're at PV Cricket Coach, and it's really busy on Twitter at the moment. I don't know whether there's been a lot more cricket people getting into the Twittering, but Twitter's taking up more and more of my time every day, it seems like. So keep tweeting us at PV Cricket Coach. You can also get us on Facebook. I post videos up there when I can, and if you do a search on Facebook for Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us, and you can click on the like button, and we can be best friends forever. That's all for this week's show. So until next week, we'll see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.